Our scripture reading this morning is from the Old Testament, Deuteronomy 6, 1 through 9, and 20 through 25. Now this is the commandment, the statutes, and the rules that the Lord your God commanded me to teach you, that you may do them in the land to which you are going over to possess it, that you may fear the Lord your God, you and your son and your son's son, by keeping all his statutes and his commandments, which I command you, all the days of your life, and that your days may be long. Hear therefore, O Israel, and be careful to do them, that it may go well with you, and that you may multiply greatly as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has promised you in a land flowing with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. And these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets before your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. And verse 20, when your son asks you in time to come, what is the meaning of the testimonies and the statutes and the rules that the Lord our God has commanded you? Then you shall say to your son, we were Pharaoh's slaves in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand, and the Lord showed signs and wonders, great and grievous, against Egypt and against Pharaoh and all his household before our eyes. And he brought us out from there, that he might bring us in and give us the land he swore to give our fathers. And the Lord commanded us to do all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God for our good always, that he might preserve us alive as we are this day. And it will be righteousness for us if we are careful to do all this commandment before the Lord our God as he commanded us. This is the word of the Lord.
I cry a fair amount, probably more than most guys, I'm guessing, I'm not sure. But if ever I was going to cry at a sermon, it would be this one. Now, I find that crying doesn't always help one communicate. It's just hard to even get a word out. So my goal is actually to not cry. But this is a bit of a setup. For one, it's the last time that I'll be preaching here as the associate pastor, and there's actually nothing on the schedule, and it is comforting to talk to Trav and to be reminded, hey, we're just right on the other side of town, like you may preach here, I may preach there, and absolutely, but it is certainly also a transition. And boy, what a privilege it has been to serve here in this way. The other reason, and there are actually a few others why I might cry, is we're talking on parenting. Are you kidding me? I mean, parenting. The amount of rescues that Jesus has made in my life in regards to parenting, they're endless, countless, every day, moment by moment. And to add to that, this is May 6th. May 6th is my daughter's birthday. She's my oldest. So it was exactly 24 years ago today that I became a parent. So here is actually a picture of that day. Karen did ask me to not keep this one up too long. So I'll move to the next one. That's me with little Jordan. She's a little bigger now. You might see a Fenway Park shirt. I figured never too early to start, like, bringing the Red Sox message. But we closed our eyes for about a second, we blinked, and then there were two. I love this picture. This, by the way, became a regular problem at least I should say it happened more than once. With my daughter, never a problem, always posed almost perfect for every picture, and my son would strategically put his hands in front of his face for the picture. So fantastic. We blinked maybe two times, and then it was like this. And I love this picture just because I love my family, but I also like that I think I'm standing on a little hill here. Because I'm taller than everybody. If you see me stand next to my son, I'm actually not taller than him, but I might be in that picture, so it's a good picture. There are, just too many reasons why I could get emotional talking about parenting. But I am excited to talk about it because it really is one of my favorite subjects. Usually when I get to talk to somebody, it is in regards to Jesus and his intervention in my life and in their life and what he might be doing. And often it's in regards to Jesus in our marriages, Jesus in our parenting, and Jesus setting us free from destructive cycles and patterns. It's really almost always these three subjects that over and over he has proven himself to be a rescuer. When I think about parenting, of course I think about my own with my kids. I also think about my role as a kid with my parents. And so in honor of my mother, I'm going to structure my outline around P's and Q's. Because I remember her telling me, and actually only her telling me, to mind my P's and Q's. And I had to look that up because I was like, what? Where did that come from? Apparently, it's centuries old that early school teachers, when they're teaching kids to write their alphabet, you know how there's a line for the P and the Q, and the only difference is what side you put the circle on? That's minding your P's and Q's. For me, it always meant you better be very careful what you say next. That there was a check on my manners, and usually a violation of manners that I was making with my mouth. So it was mind your P's and Q's. So the Q's are some questions. And I really want to answer three questions. What is wise parenting? And what is wise parenting not? And then finally, what does wise parenting produce? And by wise parenting, what I mean is parenting that is in line with God's will. That we're parenting according to his will, that's wise. When I decide to take it another route because I can, that's unwise. When I bring in my ideas and they override his ideas, or the world's ideas override his ideas, that's unwise parenting. So by wise parenting, I simply mean parenting in accordance with his will. And before I even ask the first question or try to answer the first question, just a little sidebar. I couldn't agree more with Mr. Moore, who shared in the video that parenting, the goal of parenting, ultimately what parenting is disciple making. And so when we talk about parenting, this applies to all of us believers who have heard the call and want to respond in faith to Jesus' call to go make disciples. That is actually a very simple connection, that what I find parenting to be is just intense disciple making. It's full time. It's like face to face constantly. Disciple making with other people that we might meet once a week, oh, that's disciple making, but boy, parenting, I mean, literally, they're in your kitchen, right? Like, intense disciple making. Let me start with what wise parenting is not. Wise parenting is not personal, pervasive, and permanent with problems. That when problems arise in the lives of our kids, as inevitably they will when they hit roadblocks and speed bumps and just barriers that are preventing them from moving forward, bad decisions, buried with guilt, we're encountering these problems in their lives. It is a mistake, a costly mistake, to then take these problems and say, oh, it's more than just this decision you made here. This is a problem with you. And it's affecting everything, and it's permanent. That this actually, what we'd be doing is giving a message of hopelessness. And that's actually not the message we read here in Deuteronomy 6. It's certainly not the message, the gospel of Jesus Christ. Growing up, I routinely, regularly, repeatedly had bad responses when things didn't go my way. And I know there's a few different variations of bad responses, but mine often resulted in loud rage, often on sports fields. But it didn't have to be on a sports field. It could be at a game at the kitchen table. It could be anywhere. Just this, things aren't going my way. I don't like that. And so, rah. What didn't help was just a message that I heard from all angles. And the message was this: you have a bad temper. Now, it seems like a reasonable message. But actually, what it did to me is it took this poor response that I just displayed. Maybe I'm crying as I strike out. So embarrassing, right? Walking back to the dugout, you're crying or yelling at the umpire. Instead of somebody, a coach or someone, pulling me aside and saying something along the lines of, ooh, that was an interesting response. We can even say poor response. What led you there? Why are you going there? Because actually, at that time, I already knew the good news. I had already been reading my Bible. I was already convinced he rose from the dead. The Christian question, the gospel, is you're not responding in accordance with what you believe. Why? What's going on? What are you actually believing in the moment? But when someone just says you have a bad temper, well, now it feels overwhelming, right? The problem isn't just this decision. The problem is me. Where do I go? I already believe I have a bad temper. I guess every time it comes on me, this is what I do. And it's pervasive. It's affecting everything. And it's permanent. Oh, it'll never change. Sometimes we even hear that message in church when we primarily identify ourselves as sinners. We're just sinners. Or sinners who have been saved. Like, whoa, whoa, whoa. The gospel is sinners who have been raised, new life, that the old is gone. Oh, I have an old nature that I daily put to death, but I wouldn't describe who I am in Christ as that old nature. That's never how we're described. We never, whether with our kids or anybody who we're encountering in the church, label problems as personal, pervasive, and permanent. That's a hopeless message. The gospel and Deuteronomy 6, they're messages of hope. So that what we read here in Deuteronomy 6 is the words of Moses. He says, look, I have received a command, this commandment, the statutes and rules that that the Lord's commanded me to teach you, that you might do them. And then what's it say in verse 3? That it might go well with you. This is a message of hope. God has intervened. Oh, it became a negative message when some of the Israelites decided, oh, I can just do these things, and then I'm righteous, and I actually don't need God. I don't even need faith. I just do these things. But the faithful actually never thought that. That Abraham knew he was saved by faith. That this was a message of hope in faith. Trust him. Look to him. And what he'll do is he'll lead you. Your problems don't have to be personal and pervasive and permanent. Don't believe that lie. The gospel, the good news, is that Jesus has come to make the impossible possible. When my kids or anybody I'm discipling has a bad moment in listening, maybe I feel like they're not hearing me. The message is not you are a bad listener. The message is more something like, I don't feel heard right now. What's going on? Maybe they have a self-absorbed moment. You familiar with those? I have them. The message is not you are arrogant. The message is this isn't who you are in Christ. Wise parenting knows we have a hopeful message for our kids. And in our disciple making, we have a message of hope. Here's the biggest barrier, I'm convinced, to wise parenting. We actually have to believe that our problems are not personal, pervasive, and permanent. We have to know that as believers, and believe it, moment by moment, it's actually not a decision we make once. It's a decision we make repeatedly. And you know what the evidence is that we're not believing it? If we say and do things outside of his will, it's like, oh, we're not believing this. There's some lie going on in our head that God's way isn't best or somehow I'm incapable of following. Oh, it's not the message. The message is that no temptation has seized you or me or my kids except that which is common to man, and he will provide a way out. This is a message of hope. We have to believe it for ourselves in order to avoid giving hopeless messages to our kids. Do you believe this? Do you know that in Christ, your potential to parent, you have been empowered and equipped to be great parents? This is the miracle. And he has equipped us to be great disciple makers. Go and make disciples, he said at the end of Matthew. I'm with you. You will be great. Were they great disciple makers? They were great. What does he say at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount? He goes into the Beatitudes, right? Blessed are the poor in spirit. Those who mourn will be comforted. Blessed are the meek. You'll inherit the earth. And he moves through those Beatitudes. He looks to him and says, you are the light of the world, the salt of the earth. Do we believe it? That we move into our parenting knowing we are light and salt. And our kids can be light and salt too. It is a message of hope. Okay, so we've talked about what wise parenting is not. Let's talk about what wise parenting is. And it's really clear to me in this passage, and I love it because I don't think it's the most obvious thing about parenting. In fact, sometimes we run the other direction. Wise parenting is persuasive. It is persuasive. Look at that last paragraph that we read. Deuteronomy 6, 20 to 25. It says, look, the day's coming when your son will come to you and ask you, why are we doing these things? What is the meaning of all this? It's actually not that they don't believe. It's certainly not that they haven't been practicing these statutes and laws. It's likely they have. So they're coming along and saying, hey, we're doing all these statutes and these laws, these rules, the commandment. Why are we doing them? What's the response? Oh, don't worry about it. Just believe. That is actually not the instruction. Because sometimes that brings with it this implication that we're telling our kids, you can just turn your brain off. We are not doing that. From the beginning, parents were meant to be persuasive. Like, tell your son when he comes to you and he's wondering, hey, I'm just asking, what is going on? Why do we do this? Why do we go to church? Because a lot of my friends don't. They don't believe. Why do we believe? Why are we doing this, Dad? And the response is, oh, okay, son, listen, here's how it went down. You see where we're living? No denying we're living here, right? We're living right here in Israel. We weren't always here. We were enslaved in Egypt. It was historical. They knew it. They were enslaved in Egypt. How did we break free from one of those world powers? We were just these slaves. We didn't have an army. Let me tell you how. God did the fighting. He came in. He scooped us up. There was these great signs and wonders, which of course there had to be. How else did we get out of Egypt? He moved us into this land and he gave us these statutes. That's how it all came about. Ask around, son. Go read the books. This is how it happened. It's a persuasive argument, right? It's the same for us as Christians. We don't tell our kids to just believe because we've always believed. We point back at the resurrection. In the book of Acts, there's a whole bunch of sermons. Do you know where all those preachers are pointing to at the end when all the people are listening to like Peter and Paul and like, how can you possibly believe this? Read them. Just go through Acts and pick out those sermons and tell me if they don't mention resurrection in every single one of them, that they just say, he rose. What are we supposed to do? We can talk to our kids about why the church existed. Like, look, son, look around. My daughter, look around. Look, there's churches everywhere. Where'd they come from? Where'd they start? Did they start in Williamsburg? Nope. They start in the U.S.? Nope. Where'd they start? First century, there's really no debate about it. In Jerusalem. Whoa, how did that happen? Because weren't they killing those Christians? Who dies for a lie when they know it's a lie? How else do you explain the existence of the church apart from the resurrection? That's persuasive. You know, my son went into, I asked him if he remembered it, he didn't. It was really powerful for me, so I'm hoping I'm getting the quote right. It was something like this. I want to say he was a freshman in high school. We were in Wayland, Mass. I love Wayland, Mass. There are not a lot of believers in Wayland, Mass. And there are hardly any of them teaching in the schools. So I'm pretty sure this was his freshman year in high school, if not, maybe eighth grade. But there's a teacher up there. They're powerful influencers, right? They're older and more educated. And this one particular teacher, it wasn't uncommon, was just taking shots at Christianity. Like, our youth group was in there. Our kids were in there. So that day, my son came home and said, wow, one of our teachers was really just going after Jesus and talking about how it's not true. And he said, but I knew that he didn't know about the resurrection. I was so glad to hear that, because I can bet you that actually was the case. That if we had sat down with that teacher, and this has happened to me over and over as people go after Jesus and try to say it's all just a myth or something, that when we talk about the resurrection and how do you explain the existence of the church early first century when they're being so persecuted, eyewitnesses, how do you explain that apart from the resurrection? And you know what happens? It doesn't get explained apart from the resurrection. Wise parenting and wise disciple making is persuasive. We talk about Jesus' resurrection. But not just Jesus' resurrection. We also talk about Jesus' resurrection in us are resurrection stories. Look, I have a whole bunch of them. I bet you do too. Like, people come, and you know why I want to talk to them about parenting? Because I want to talk to them about how when I go my own way, I fail. Look at these failures of mine. Here's what he's done. He's intervened and forgiven me and pulled me out of this pit of when I try to parent my way and not his. And he offers forgiveness and hope, and he leads me. There's a death resurrection in my parenting. My marriage hit a point so low, I just never thought it was ever going to go there. And Jesus came and he rescued us. He rescued me. He forgives me and walks with me. I have resurrection stories. Old destructive habits that hung around for decades that I thought would never change. I thought they defined me. And he comes along and says, they don't define you, and I forgive you, and I'll change you. So that when our kids come and they're stuck and they've hit bottoms, we can relate. And we have our own resurrection stories. That when they share, like, I feel dead in the water, we say, I know what it's like. Here's what he's done for me. He's still raising us from the dead. Moment by moment, he sustains us. Paul said, since then, you've been raised with Christ. Put to death the old nature and live. Moment by moment, we bring our stories of resurrection to our kids. I want to say too, I meant to say it back up when we said believe. If you're a parent, my guess is you've made some mistakes. Can I say, I had someone tell me, not even a believer, it was really wise advice. She said, look, your kids can recover from your mistakes. What they're going to have trouble recovering from is when you make mistakes and you tell them it's their mistake. We do it. We can do it. Here's what we do when we think, that was a mistake. Apologize. Apologize. Just go apologize to your kid. It's so evident, by the way, when we do it, that we believe in a resurrection, that we experience this resurrection. All right. So wise parenting is not personal, pervasive, and permanent in regards to problems, with problems. Wise parenting is persuasive. One final question, one final cue. What does wise parenting produce? What does it produce? I want to say wise parenting produces wise, what would you guess? Kids, adults, like wise kids, wise adults, that sort of thing. I don't think that's what the text says. The text says, wise parenting produces wise parents. That what we see in verse 2 is, look, you have this commandment, these statutes and these laws, and look, I've given them to you so that you'll do them, and that in doing them, you'll fear the Lord as you guard his commandment, that you will fear the Lord, you and your sons' sons. Now, I very much hope to have an impact on my son's sons or my daughter's daughter or my grandkids. I trust that by God's grace, I can, God willing, if they're there and I have them. But really, who are we counting on to impact our sons' sons or our daughter's daughters? We're counting on our sons and daughters. That actually, when we share the resurrection of Jesus Christ with them, it becomes their story. That we just are presenting him as true. And as we recognize, we recognize him as true, that they can recognize him as true. If he really is risen, right? Is he risen? We present him as true. They believe. And they begin to have their own resurrection stories that we get to see and remind them of. And we can encourage them to remind their kids. It is just like disciple making. Wise disciple making makes wise disciple makers. And wise parenting produces wise parents. I'm going to end in just a minute, but I have to highlight one tension before I do. There is this tension out there. That when I look at the lives of my kids, it is really impossible for me to separate myself entirely from their decision making. I'll probably never know to what degree I'm impacting their decision making. That we have an impact on our kids. That wise parenting, it will impact them, and so will poor parenting. It will impact them. But in the end, I'm not trying to remove the miracle piece. That there is a decision going on in their lives as well. And Ginny Woodward said, five kids, I need five miracles. I agree 100%. That we could actually parent perfectly if we did, and we haven't. We could parent perfectly, and they could still not become wise parents. The reason we know this is Jesus was a perfect disciple maker. But not everybody he spoke to became a disciple or a disciple maker. That there's a tension. We have a clear role. That wise parenting has been drawn up for us, what it looks like and what it doesn't look like and what it produces. But there is a piece in there that is beyond our control. And one final application. And if it's the only one you remember, take it. I pray it's this one. The application is pray. Pray. Pray for your kids. Pray for yourself. Pray for your wife. Pray for your parenting. Pray for your kids that they might be set apart for His glory, that you could speak wisely. When you're disciple making, pray for wisdom as you speak to those who are lost. Pray for wisdom as you speak to those who are struggling. Pray for our ability. Pray for them. Pray. Pray. Pray.